Welcome to Executive Report. Today, we are blessed to have Ed Norris join us, and he's going to talk about the story really of his life and what's transpired over the years and how it led to where he is today, which is pretty successful. So I know everyone in the Baltimore, Maryland area already knows the name and knows the story, but for those that are joining us from around the country and even internationally, I'll read a quick little bio just so you have an idea of what we're talking about. So Ed spent 20 years as a crime-fighting savant in the New York Police Department, rising from a beat cop to a deputy commissioner of operations at age 36. As police commissioner of Baltimore, he was really a breath of life into what was a demoralized force at the time. And it was infamous for homicide counts and a lot of other well, if you've watched The Wire, you basically know what it is. after the 9/11 attacks, he took over as the Maryland State Police and pushed an innovative anti-terrorism strategies that made a national leader on the field. At the University of Virginia, they taught a graduate course about how his leadership techniques transformed one of the most violent cities in the country. And then things kind of changed a little bit. A lot of stuff came crashing down. An investigation into a police expense account morphed into what many people felt at the time and now know was a politically motivated hit job by a federal prosecutor and landed him in federal prison. But thankfully, it's not all bad. Nope. and he's now the co-host of what's the area's most popular sports talk show on a 105.7 The Fan in the Baltimore area. And he's really living life to the fullest, you know. So welcome to Executive Reports.
Thank you.
So I've heard you say before that they treat you like a king in Baltimore. Is that true?
Absolutely, positively. Especially after things came crashing down when people found out the truth. I became, even people that didn't like me because they didn't like the police, I became kind of a sympathetic character, especially when people feel like they're treated unfairly by the criminal justice system. So people people would shout out to me in the mall and, "You did it, you beat them." It's just... Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
Well, and you know, after reading your book, I mean, honestly, your story is something that would be right out of a movie. It's a Hollywood plot line, honestly. And it makes you really doubt the legitimacy of our legal systems and how things actually work. Now, in your case, mm-hmm. the prosecutor, you know, was fired, so there was some retribution there. But at the time, that probably didn't make you feel any better, right?
I was in prison when I got fired.
Yeah. So
I was already there.
Yes. So, I mean, how bad did it get? What was the worst moment you remembered?
Well, I mean, it was kind of a bad decade, but the worst moments, I think, were when the indictment came down. You know, I'm reading them, and I can beat this. This isn't true. I read all the particulars. Like, this is mm-hmm. nonsense. And then I got to the last page, and they had an indictment. They indicted me for a false statement on a mortgage application, mm-hmm. and I knew they had me because what happened was that when I bought my home in Baltimore, my father gave me $9,000 just for, you know, I didn't need it, actually, just in case, for closing costs and all the other expenses that year. And so we signed a letter saying it was a gift. Sometime later, years later, I paid him back because we're not moneyed people. So I gave him back the $9,000. So I got indicted for falsifying a mortgage application because then the gift became a loan. So it wasn't actually stealing money, but giving money back. And I was indicted for that. And when it came down to it, well, this is stupid. Well, not really, because they told me if I didn't plead guilty to the stuff I didn't do, they would drop the charge I was actually guilty of. Or I wouldn't see my son grow up was the words they used. So
wow.
I would have said I shot JFK at that point.
Yeah.
So.
Wow, that's incredible. And I think when you ended up going to prison, you went to Atlanta, right?
No, that's where I ended up.
Oh, that's where you ended up.
I went to three different places.
Really?
I went to Eglin Air Force Base in Florida, up in the Panhandle. I was there about 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and the hurricane came. Three hurricanes were bearing down.
Jeez.
And they evacuated us, just said, get your Bible and your shaving kit and get in the mess hall. And they put us on prison buses. They don't tell you where you're going, obviously. Mm-hmm. So they put us on buses all, you know, cuffed up. And we went to Yazoo City, Mississippi, to a maximum security prison that wasn't open yet. And we slept on the floor there for 3 months. And then we got our final destinations, and I was assigned to Atlanta, which was... Didn't make me very happy.
No.
It's one of the most dangerous prisons in the country.
Oh, is it really?
So when I heard it was Atlanta, I was like, whoa, this is bad.
And I'm sure being a former commissioner of police, I mean, you probably weren't the most popular person.
No, it's funny you say that, though. The guys I went with, we were the last, because they traversed through the South. We went to Talladega, went to different places through the South, finally getting to Atlanta. And I told the guy next to me, I said, I'm really afraid here. This is, I can get hurt here. Because they had a reputation for a lot of stabbings and deaths and stuff. And he got up and told, said, nobody gives up Eddie's profession. 22 guys.
Really?
Yeah. Try keeping 22 of your friends quiet. I served out the last couple of months there, and nobody said a word. Nobody said anything. So nobody knew except the guys I went with. So I had a long beard at the time. I told people I was a meth dealer, and that's that.
Wow. So you finally get through all that mess.
Yeah.
And you're getting ready to be released. And I'm sure you were counting down the days, right? Anybody would.
Oh, yeah.
So you get out, and then what happens? Did you have any kind of career plans?
No. No. I mean, they took every penny plus 10 cents. They don't leave you with any money, which is the other half. People have no idea. They just take everything financially from you. Now I'm a convict, no money. I'm in my mid-40s, and my background is policing, so I can't do that anymore. So I end up, just trying to get a job to support my family. And I got a job at the mall selling razors and, at some fancy cologne store. And then someone found out who I was, and I got fired from the mall. But I got a call from, because the prosecutor had been fired for misconduct.
That's right.
Some people in his office, ratted him out and said, he's doing outrageous things here. So DOJ came in, investigated, he was fired. And when that came out, a radio station in Baltimore called me and said, would you want to talk about it? I was like, yeah, I'll talk about it. And then I did. And then they offered me a job part-time because I was under house arrest in Tampa. I was living in Florida.
Okay.
So I did it for an hour a day from my house. And then it became popular. So they said, would you like to do full-time? So I came back and I got my own radio show. And 17 years later, we have the number one show in Baltimore. Yeah. So, it's funny how I never saw that coming because there was some dark days, believe me.
Yeah, I'm sure there were. I mean, especially, right out. I mean, I would imagine most people, they wouldn't have been able to persevere and get through it.
No, I mean, look, everything goes through your head. Suicide, people jump into alcohol bottles, they kill themselves. You know your life is over, at least as you knew it.
Yeah.
It's never going to be the same. And it's very, very hard. I went to see a therapist after this just to talk about everything. And he said to me, I told him everything I lost. I lost my money, my career, most of my friends because they couldn't fraternize with me, my hobbies because a lot of them had to do with guns and shooting and hunting and stuff. And he said, I've never seen someone lose so much in one incident. And I'm thinking, this is a guy that sees broken people for a living. And I am the worst case you've ever seen. And didn't make me feel much better. So it was a tough climb.
Yeah. But something had to keep you motivated. I mean, did you have something in your mind that says, if I can only get to this point or see this person or something?
Well, yeah, I'm a native New Yorker, so tell me I can't do something. So, yeah, that's what kept me motivated. And my son, I have a family. My son was very young at the time. Had to support him.
Yeah.
So, you gotta do what you gotta do.
Got it. So you really had no idea you were going to end up in radio.
Not in a million years.
And I'm really curious, when you started part-time, did you anticipate something more would come out of it? Or you're like, this...
No, I was just happy to have a job. I was just happy to earn a living because I was not, I had no prospects. The only thing that kept me employed was The Wire. I was an actor on The Wire. And David Simon was really good to me. He gave me a lot of acting roles in the fourth and fifth seasons, which kept some money coming in.
Okay.
But other than that, I had nothing, and The Wire was not going to go on forever.
No.
So, he kept me afloat for a little bit, and I fell into radio. And then that's my new career. And then I do local television here on the, local Fox 45. I do news, and I do the radio, and I've just got other acting roles out of this. So.
Excellent. Yeah. I'm curious, what other acting roles?
I did a documentary on Jack the Ripper.
Did you really?
Yeah, to investigate the case. So they flew me to England. I read the original case, went to the bars he picked up the prostitutes in. And I did a whole investigation in London and the U.S. because we believe he came here. And it was pretty fascinating. So it was really fun. So I got that, and I got another one coming up now regarding some rather expensive thefts that have been unsolved.
That's pretty cool. It's like a cold case thing.
Yeah, I created the cold case squad in NYPD. That's my background.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I created and commanded the first cold case squad in New York. And there was a book written about it, a TV series. So when they found out about it, they sought me. And Discovery Channel gave me the job. They just didn't know who I was, but they told, go find this guy. And that's how I got the job at solving cold cases.
Got it. So when we were talking the other day, you know, I honestly, I look at you, you have a sense of celebrity, you're treated like a king, using mm-hmm. your words, in Baltimore. You don't have to deal with the politics anymore. You don't have to deal with what's going on in Baltimore. And I honestly, I thought, you know, he's probably in a much better place and happier. But you said that you miss it.
I do miss it.
And that was surprising to me, because I really thought who would miss those things, honestly. But
well, I don't miss those things. I miss the work.
Okay.
I miss the work. You know, look at the city. Look at the country. Crime's up everywhere. Baltimore is more dangerous than most dangerous countries.
Yeah.
People have no idea how dangerous it is here. And I feel like I can make a difference. And that's why I really miss it, because there's not many people that know what I know. Because I was trained under Jack Maple. Mm-hmm. People know, he's pretty well known in our circles anyway. It's like getting your black belt from Bruce Lee. I mean, I learned how to reduce crime from him when he did it in New York, when I was at his, you know, right hand. So I just watch what's going on. It makes me sad. And I mean, look, I have a great life. I mean, I have a radio job. It's popular. I'm on television. I make more money than I made as police commissioner. Mm-hmm. I have no complaints in that way. And I, you know, no one's calling me 3 a.m. to respond to a police shooting. But I do miss the work. I really do. Cause it's important, and you need to, it's, you know, I always tell people, you may not like me, but if your mother was a crime victim, you'd want me to be the investigator.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Well, and if memory serves, I think your time as commissioner was the only time that crime went down as far as it did.
It's the first time in like decades it went down. And sharply, we led the country every year in crime decline for major cities.
So I'm curious, from your professional, you know, perspective, I mean, how do you even begin to solve what's happening in Baltimore right now?
Oh, I could solve this in a couple months.
Really?
100%. It's one of those things where you watch people in whatever profession you're in. When you see someone who's in the same profession and you talk to them and watch what they're doing, you go, they have no idea what they're doing.
So you can recognize it immediately.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like anybody, you know, a doctor or, you know, a plumber or whatever business you're in, you know, he has no idea what he's doing. And that's what I'm watching. They have no idea what they're doing. And they abandoned all the things that were brought here when I got here, which worked.
Yeah.
And it continued under one of my successes, Fred Bielfeld, drove crime down even further. Mm-hmm. And they've abandoned all that. And, you know, they throw up their hands and wonder why people are getting murdered at a clip like you see in third world countries. Okay. But it's certainly fixable.
So is there reasons why they abandon those things at all? I mean, you wouldn't think you would just stop doing what works just for the hell of it. I mean,
well, there's always the, you know, not invented here, where people just, they like to bring their own ideas.
Okay.
And then there's a tremendous New York bias here, where people just, I don't know if it's just the Yankees or whatever they hate about New York, but they just, things New York just rub people the wrong way. But it worked, and it works, and it would work now. And I cannot believe that they're not at least trying some of them, because they're comparing things from year to year. They need to compare crime now versus 20 years ago when I was here.
Yeah.
And look how much it's totally different now. Hundreds and hundreds of people are murdered every year that need not be. And the fact that we shrug it off like, well, that's Baltimore, is just unacceptable.
Yeah, and just the small things, they seem to be just spiraling out of control. Things like the squeegee kids and
everything.
And I remember back in like 1999, mm-hmm. I'd drive by the police impound lot right off of 40, and I would see what seemed like hundreds of dirt bikes.
Yeah.
There's not one single dirt bike there now, but we do know that they're on the streets.
They don't enforce anything. They don't enforce minor regulations. They don't enforce major regulations.
Yeah.
If you take care of, because you not only want to make cities safer, for real, like really safer, fewer people murdered, fewer people robbed, but it has to feel safer.
That's right.
You're not going to attract any business. People are going to close the businesses, and they are, because no one goes downtown. You're not going to get conventions. You're not going to get, you know, there's going to be no hope of all-star games or things like that in this town, because no one wants to come here. Because it's deemed too dangerous, because everywhere you go, there's disorder. There's squeegee guys, dirt bikes, begging, and there's real crime, even in the tourist areas.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So you're a radio star. You're obviously a television star now with the Cold Case stuff. What's next for Ed Norris?
I don't know. I may write another book.
Do you?
I wrote a book, and that one was about my life and just all the things. Like, I had the first Al-Qaeda arrest in the U.S. I had the plans for 9/11. I've had an incredibly interesting life. I wish it was somebody else's, but it's mine, so I own it.
So hold on, don't go too far. I got to rewind a little bit there. You said you had the plans for 9/11.
100%.
Yeah. You have to explain that because I know that people are listening and saying, what the hell?
That's true. I was a detective lieutenant commanding the Upper East Side of Manhattan, the 17th Detective Squad, and there was a murder in a hotel. Mm-hmm. And there's never any, this is where the richest people in the country live. Like Henry Kissinger lived there, and it was Katharine Hepburn, and there are a lot of celebrities settled up there. So it was a murder. It was Meir Kahane was a speaker. He was doing a book signing. He's a very fiery, radical Jewish leader. And, man of an Egyptian naturalized American citizen, but he's an Egyptian, came in as he was at the podium signing books and shot him to death. Flees, runs out to Lexington Avenue, jumps in a cab, jumps out immediately, gun in hand, which is important. Uniformed police officer sees him. They get in a gun battle, both wounded, both live. So we go through his papers, and in there I find a note, a piece of paper, with every elected official in New York State who happened to be Jewish. It's like, well, that's odd.
Yeah.
There was a search warrant on his house, and who answered the door at 1 o'clock in the morning? Two other Egyptian men. Not surprised to see the police there. Happened to be cab drivers at the scene at the time of the shooting, they admit. He jumped in the wrong cab.
Oh,
I see. That was his getaway car, and then he missed it because they would shoot around the corner by Meter Maids and move. And we locked them up for murder. And then we did a search warrant, and in there we found all kinds of stuff. I didn't know what it was because it was mostly in Arabic. So, but there were pictures with bomb-making manuals, thousands of rounds of ammunition, surveillance photos of our landmarks, police headquarters, FBI building, the Trade Center, Brooklyn Bridge. So I went to brief the chief of detectives the next morning, and I told him, he said, can you tell me there's a lone gunman? I said, no, of course not. I said, I don't know what I have, but it's big. I said, they have three people for murder. I have all this stuff I can't read, but I know it's something. You had a black and white composition book like you had as a kid.
Yeah.
There was a little sketch in there. It looked like an armored car stick-up, I thought. It was not. It was the plot to kill Hosni Mubarak. And I had all this stuff in my hands. He told me literally, he said, you shut up. You handle murders. They handle conspiracies. We had a joint terrorism task force in the room, FBI, NYPD. They turned all those documents over to the feds. Fast forward, I get transferred to another assignment downtown. The Trade Center gets bombed in 93.
Yep.
What I left out was the drivers were released. They released the drivers saying not enough evidence, nonsense. It was another motive. I'm assuming they wanted to follow them more. They knew all about these guys. The people that were released drove the van into the Trade Center in 93.
Yep.
They blew up the Trade Center. 6 dead, 1,000 injured. They put the van in the wrong place. They finally translate the documents midway through that trial, and it says in the documents, Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. And the whole plot was take down the buildings of which Americans are so proud, the wealth and power of the United States, et cetera, et cetera. That was the plot. That was the plot for 9/11.
Yeah.
So if you go to 9/11 Museum in New York now, as you leave, there's a plaque saying this was not the first attempt, and it details what I just told you.
Wow. Wow, that's incredible. And the feds weren't able to put it together.
Well, I'm more angry at the NYPD because my own department, because we acquiesced. You know, they had a clearance for the murder. Boom, we're done. Move on. And we should have investigated it further. We had translators. Hmm. We're four times the size of the FBI.
Oh,
people forget that. You know, it's 50,000 employees in the NYPD.
Oh, wow.
We had Arabic translators. We could have read these documents. But I was 30 years old, so nobody takes you seriously. Seriously, if I was, my age now, they listen.
Yeah. So anyway, I diverged there for a second. So you might write another book.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to retire, move to warmer climate? I mean, what?
Well, I lived in Tampa. I wouldn't mind going back south. I like the sunshine. I like the beach. I like the way of life. I'm too young to retire. I still have a lot to say, a lot to do. So I like to get involved in policing again. I like to help departments that can't seem to figure it out. And
like work as a consultant type thing?
Yeah, I mean, this is really doable. And people are missing, they're really missing the mark badly. And, they're so focused on consent decrees and having the police not touch anybody. It's a dirty business.
Yeah.
You deal with very dangerous people. I don't know why folks can't understand this. There's really dangerous people out there. We just had a doctor from Hopkins shot in a carjacking. Hmm. There's innocent people just driving to work and being shot in this town, in every town across the United States, here more than there. But you need to combat this. And I don't know what flipped in America where we're so over-concerned with the rights of criminals and we've abandoned the rights of the people that live behind, 15 locks on their doors and can't come out in their neighborhoods, who are, the vast majority, just good people trying to live their lives the way we live ours. They just want to live their lives.
That's right.
And they're forgotten about. And we're so concerned with guys selling drugs and running guns and, God forbid somebody gets hurt in this. Look, people may not like this. It's a brutal business. It's like the military. You know, this is not a joke. You make a mistake in your business if you're an accountant. It's a financial mistake. You make a mistake in policing, you don't go home to your kids.
That's right.
That's that. I'm going home every night, and I will do anything I have to do to make sure I go home. Anything. And if you don't, you're a fool. And people need to understand this. And I think people have an amazing capacity for the truth. If you tell people this and show them, put them through the simulators, put them through what we go through when you're trying to decide shoot, don't shoot. And only I brought the whole media corps here once. they shot everybody. Yeah. It's a very tough thing to do. And people need to be educated. And police need to be the police again. They're not report takers. And that's, you can't be, we don't need clerks. We need warriors. We need police officers, and we've walked away from that.
Ironically, I have a friend whose name is Thor, and he actually does simulation. He runs an association, and he does simulations for police officers.
Really?
And other things. Yeah. And he does a great job of it. And that's exactly what he says.
Really?
People don't understand until they're in the situation. Yeah, and just, he does a great job. But well, Ed, I thank you so much for coming. It's been a pleasure being here. For all you people out there that are listening, hit that like button, hit the subscribe, and share it the best you can. And hopefully we'll see you again sometime.
Yeah, you will.
Thanks. Right.